From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's the new year, and many people use it as an opportunity to press reset and make personal changes. Meanwhile, the U.S. government remains shut down. An opposition Congress begins today. And at the close of 2018, an Atlantic Public Religion Research Institute poll found that nearly two-thirds of Americans felt deeply pessimistic about the direction the country has taken. So we've invited leaders from different faith traditions to share some of the issues and messages and conversations animating their respective congregations at the dawn of a new year. Joining me in the studio is Kim Jackson, Associate Rector of All Saints Episcopal Church in Atlanta. Kim, great to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me again.
And also Sumaya Khalifa. She's Executive Director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Sumaya, welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
Thanks for being here. And Rabbi Robert Haas from Congregation Mikvah Israel joins us from Savannah. And Rabbi Robert, welcome.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you. I'm going to start with Kim and Robert. Often the first sermon or message of the New Year sets an intention for the rest of the season. What were your messages to your congregations about 2019? I'll start with you, Kim.
Yeah, sure. So my first message will actually be this Sunday, and so I don't want to give too much away.
No spoilers.
Sure, but certainly it is a message of hope. As we think about, on Sunday we celebrate Epiphany, which is when the kings arrive to shower these gifts with baby Jesus. And so thinking about how hopeful they were, and also thinking about the ways that people from all across the world unite around images and models of hope. And so, you know, Christianity is not this exclusive thing where it's only for those people who are in Palestine, or in our context, it's not just for, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants either, right? That this message of hope goes across such a large span of people. And so it really is a call, I think, for unity, and also to recognize that people see hope and find life in a variety of contexts that extend beyond our kind of traditional Episcopal way of worship.
How about for you, Rabbi Robert? Are you willing to give us any spoilers?
Well, I think she's said a lot of what I'll be speaking about it. But also for us, you know, we base each, you know, sermon on the Torah portion of the week, and we're in the book of Exodus. So for us, it'll be a lot about freedom and the idea that, you know, freedom is wonderful. We live in this great country. We can sit down and watch football on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday at our couch. But the true meaning of freedom is not to be able to do whatever you want, but it's a sense of responsibility. The idea that it's our responsibility to make this world a little bit better. And I think this year, one of the ways we can do it is teach each other to show respect for everybody else.
Right.
I think respect is the key.
Sumaya, you're not leading a congregation, but you interact with so many folks with your role at the Islamic Speakers Bureau. What kind of conversations have you been having about intentions for 2019?
Well, we focus on the positive and build on that. In Islam, there is a concept that there is, with every hardship, there is ease that follows it. And also that life is a test. It's not all good and fun. There's some bad times that will teach us lessons, and good times that would also teach us lessons. So we try to optimize on whatever we're going through. And we want to pull together as a community, as a state, as a city, with everybody to make the world a better world.
So we're talking about resiliency. We're talking about finding hope in a lot of different places. And I'm wondering, for you, what is the process of reflecting on the year past and starting out with new intentions? How do you do that individually and as a part of a community? Robert, I'll start with you.
Well, I think one is you look back at the year and you say to yourself, yes, I think there was a lot of things that went wrong. I think a lot of people were not in the right frame of mind. But you also look back and say, hey, there were a lot of wonderful things last year. We may not have spoken about them as much, but they were there. And I think this year, not only do we concentrate on overcoming the things that weren't what we wanted them to be, but also let's look at all the positives and say, hey, yes, it was a difficult year. There were a lot of issues, but there are a lot of wonderful things, especially person-to-person, community-to-community, that happened that we need to also continue to focus on, even as we improve the things that weren't quite what we hoped they would be.
Yeah, so do you, Kim, go through some kind of, I don't know, how do you go to the well at the end of the year, especially a year like this? I mean, a year of burnout. A lot of people feel burnout on politics, seemingly jam-packed news cycle, fatigue with always-on social media culture. How do you do it?
Yeah, so definitely have taken some time to recount some, you know, major events that have happened in the life of our nation, in the life of our state. And, you know, I find places where that can be really dark and depressing. But I'm also just very aware of the amount of celebrations that I've been able to be involved in as well. And so when I think about talking to my congregation and when I talk to them, you know, we also remember the weddings and the amazing funerals that we had where we celebrated lives well lived. And those are the stories also to remember, along with also being mindful of the way that, yes, there is still work to be done, right? So particularly in our congregation, we began conversations and continued conversations around race issues and around the Me Too movement. And that work must continue into 2019, right? And so I remain mindful of that while also trying to balance that with celebrations of the positive things that have happened, the things that we've accomplished in 2018.
So those are big social issues that right. can be potentially very divisive or people have opinions about it. So what does it feel like to lead a whole congregation in those kind of conversations?
It's really hard and it's complex. And I think, you know, the rabbi mentioned the importance of respect, and that has been, I think, a leading ethos and value for us is to respect different opinions. We have a large congregation with many, many different opinions and different values. And so trying to respect those while also paying attention to people who are particularly harmed. As it relates to the Me Too movement, being really clear that there are women particularly, but others as well, who have been harmed by sexual assault. And we're going to name that, and we're going to offer, you know, a service for those women in particular, that we're not going to shy away from that while also maintaining openness to having conversations with others who have different beliefs and values.
Well, I'm going to follow up on that because, you know, we all know the expression preaching to the choir. So it assumes you're talking to people who are already convinced of something, that the way that it goes. How do you make room for other voices?
Yeah, so I don't believe that in our congregation there really is a choir necessarily. I think for me this last year, I've spent a lot of time trying to be honest about the places where I have questions and I have doubts, which therefore has given space for people who have different opinions to offer something to me and to counter maybe what I might be thinking. And we also try to be intentional about bringing different voices to come and to speak to our congregation, right? And so during Holy Week, ironically perhaps, but during Holy Week, we had a Muslim, a rabbi, and then a Christian scholar who came in and talked to us so that we could hear these different perspectives and learn and expand our own way of thinking.
That's what we're after today. That's Kim Jackson from All Saints Episcopal Church in Atlanta, also with us Sumaya Khalifa from the Islamic Speakers Bureau in Atlanta, and Rabbi Robert Haas from Congregation Mikvah Israel in Savannah. Sumaya, I didn't ask you, your end of year intentions, is there a contemplative practice that you do in your faith or just personally?
Well, a lot of prayers. Muslims pray 5 times a day and, you know, take that seriously. And also being connected with the Supreme Being, God. And we look at what we have been able to accomplish as an organization in 2018 and celebrate that. There's a lot of work to be done, as was mentioned before by Kim and the rabbi. And we look forward to 2019 to continue that. Some of the major things that we did in Atlanta include starting a leadership institute for the Muslim community. We did not have one. And so that was a major accomplishment for us to do.
So how about for you, Rabbi Robert? How do you make room inside of your church community and tradition for voices that may not agree?
Well, I think that's the whole part of being part of a congregation, is we have a variety of voices, and it's, you know, allowing them to have their own voice while respecting what they say and understanding that everybody's not going to agree. I mean, we've done a lot of the same things that were mentioned. We had a tri-faith service a few weeks ago with a minister and an imam and a rabbi. It sounds like the start to a joke, but it's not. You know, we have speakers come. We're going to have a civil rights investigators come. We have somebody who speaks about the history of our immigration, Jewish immigration to the country. But I think it's a lot, again, as we've been talking about, it's looking at the wonderful things we've done, because I think we have to continue to preach to the choir and remind them, because if you don't remind people that they're doing right, they're going to forget about it. But then again, it is our responsibility to reach out across the table to a wide variety of areas. And our synagogue works in a wide variety of ways in our community, not just religiously, but doing things with the police department, with people of other cultures, other religions. And it's a nice way to show everyone that we're all in it together, because if we want to make this world better, you can't do it in just yourself and your own community. You've got to reach out to others and do it together. And if somebody's going through a difficult time, the best way to help them is not just to do it yourself, but bring other people in to show, hey, this is a problem for all of us.
I'm wondering, I'm sure all of you have conversations with your colleagues in other regions and places. For you, how do you guide people of faith in the South? Is it different? And does that play out differently in your congregations than the conversations you have with others? Kim, you're nodding.
Yeah, I think that South is a very particular place as it relates to religion, because everyone is assumed to be Christian at the first face and to be a particular type of Christian.
People have said to me, which church do you go to?
Right. And so I think particularly in my congregation, a lot of thought is going into, you know, how do we be Christians who aren't Southern Baptists? And how do we engage with people who maybe have more conservative or more traditional ways of thinking about what Christianity is about, and the importance of saying, you know, we're Episcopalians and we have certain beliefs and we are still Christians. And this is another model to be kind of progressive thought thinkers and leaders while being people of faith, that's really important. And also, it's important to give my people the courage to claim that title of Christian and to not let it be co-opted by people who only believe a certain way about what it means to be a Christian.
And Sumaya, how about for you? I mean, in a predominantly Christian place, if you are a Muslim observant, you are easily identifiable. Right now, you're wearing a headscarf.
Yeah. Right, absolutely. So it's twofold. One fold is that people would look at Muslims who are identified as Muslims, but you don't belong here, you don't speak English, you're not American. And I love that when I encounter something like this, I go up to them and with my most Southern accent, I talk to them, and that kind of blows their mind. So this is one part. The other part is that building coalitions and having faith communities who are different from each other, such as the Christian community, the Jewish community, Hindu community, coming together to work together on social issues that we are facing as a city and as a state, such as hunger, such as gun violence, etc., really brings people together. So having a focus and people who are like-minded on certain issues brings people together.
Rabbi Robert, we have just a minute before the break. Can you add something to that about the sort of otherizing in a Southern community?
It's great being in the South. I mean, I think a lot of people are religious here, but they're also mostly very appreciative of others. I mean, people come up to you and say, oh, you're the rabbi from that Jewish church downtown. Think you guys are wonderful. So I think it's not always people understand that there are different types of religions or how they work, but people are appreciative. I was just talking with somebody at the hospital, a chaplain, who said, you know, when she goes up to visit somebody, if they're religious, she automatically finds that connection no matter what religion they are, because they have a certain way about them. And I thought that was really beautiful.
All right. So we've got a rabbi, we've got a priest, and we have a representative from the Muslim faith. And in keeping with the theme today, we're hearing music from the Maccabees singing This Is the New Year, Rosh Hashanah. And we're going to be back with more in a moment on Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're opening the new year with a conversation with religious leaders about how they are guiding their flocks in an increasingly polarized and secular America. Kim Jackson is Associate Rector of All Saints Episcopal Church in Atlanta. Sumaya Khalifa is Executive Director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. And Rabbi Robert Haas of Congregation Mikvah Israel is with us from Savannah. So I'd like to ask a little bit more about beliefs and practices in this new year, according to the Gregorian calendar, but your respective faiths mark beginnings of the year at different times. Can you each briefly tell us when your liturgical calendars reset or religions otherwise celebrate a new year? How about you, Sumaya?
Sure. Muslims follow for their holiday observances, etc., the Hijri or calendar or Islamic calendar. And it was marked when Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, migrated from Mecca to Medina, and he took his followers there. And so that marked the year one for the Muslims.
And when is that?
It's a lunar calendar, so it changes every year. It's 11 days earlier. And that took place at the end of September, I believe, this year. So we're in 1440 Islamic calendar. So it's a little bit different.
So 1440 for you. How about in the Christian calendar? It's slightly different.
Right. Our New Year starts in December, maybe early late November, depending on. But it starts with Advent 1. That's the beginning of our new liturgical year, which is when we begin to talk about and prepare for the birth of Jesus. So that's kind of how we mark time. It's close to the new year, but not quite the new year. But liturgically, it's Advent 1.
And how about for you, Rabbi Robert? People in the secular world, they often make New Year's resolutions and commitments to better ourselves. How about in your faith calendar? Is there reflection or anything in particular that has a deeper meaning?
Well, I think we always make those type of New Year's resolutions. We have our New Year's is in September. It's called Rosh Hashanah. It's kind of the birthday of the world and the day of judgment, where you're kind of ceremoniously or metaphorically judged for your sins, and then you're relieved of them as on what we call Yom Kippur. But I think for us as Jews, and I think it's essential that we remember, and you know, resolutions are wonderful, but the idea of a resolution once a year really is not as nice or as meaningful as if you continually have resolutions, as you're continually looking to improve yourself, not just saying once a year, I'm going to make this giant improvement, because we know that always doesn't work. I'm not going to eat any sugar this whole year. Mm-hmm. For us, it's kind of like making a resolution every month or every week, but small ones as we go along. And then maybe once a year, kind of looking back and saying, hey, we made some good choices. Let's do some new things this year. But it's, you know, one step at a time.
Well, we have just come to the end of the Christmas season here. And according to most Christian calendars, we're still in Christmas season. Even people of other faiths who grew up without religion know that this is celebrating the birth of Christ, but few people really know of its origins. When and how did it start, Kim?
Right. So how did Christmas?
Yes, the whole idea of it, because it is originally it was a pagan holiday, wasn't it? The solstice or the end of the lunar calendar?
Sure. Yeah, I think there's a lot of debate actually about whether or not we adapted this pagan holiday of the solstice and kind of co-opted it. I think there's some truth to that. You know, there's a lot of scholarship around when was Jesus actually born, and we feel pretty clear it wasn't in December. We know for sure that there wasn't snow on the ground, and it wasn't a wintry white Christmas.
Not in Palestine.
Not in Palestine. We acknowledge that. But, you know, there was a consensus that came together that we needed to celebrate the birth of Christ, and December 25th kind of won in this longer argument about when we might do that.
Mm-hmm. So for you, Sumaya and Rabbi, Christianity, largest religion in the U.S., and retailers have certainly made Christmas a secular holiday. So what is this time like for you, or this time that just passed? Do you feel left out, or do you practice secular traditions, Sumaya?
Well, it's a really fun time of the year for me. Excuse me. I'm a shopper, and so it's a great time to be out there finding good buys. But it's a very festive time. Everybody's happy. Everybody is friendly. They want to talk. And on a personal level, that is my favorite time. Personally, don't celebrate it as such, but celebrate with my friends who do celebrate to wish them a Merry Christmas. And one point that I want to make is that my family's originally from Egypt, mm-hmm. and I just came back from there on a vacation. And Christmas there is January 7th for the Coptic Christians. But if you go to Egypt, like I was, they have Christmas decorations all over that is just on par with the best here in the U.S.
You mean like traditional, like we would think
yes,
of Christmas poinsettias, decorations, wreaths,
poinsettias, everything. It was just really amazing to see that.
How about for you, Rabbi? You know, a lot of people that I know who grew up in the Jewish tradition of a certain era, they celebrated Christmas because that's what everyone else was doing.
Well, I actually just wrote a sermon about how much I love Christmas, and it's so pertinent to me for so many ways. First of all, most of the Christmas music was written by Jews. So to all the Christians out there, you're welcome. Secondly, Hanukkah, which is a very minor holiday that happens around the same time of the year, has become a very powerful, wonderful way of celebrating the holidays with our Christian neighbors, even though it's a minor holiday. You know, our kids get to give gifts as well. And thirdly, for me particularly, my wife is Jewish, but her family is Christian, and we were married just the last 2.5 years. So I've celebrated Christmas for the first time myself with her family, and I have a new baby, so it's the first time I've got to see her open presents and see how it's celebrated. So it's a wonderful time of year, and my dad, of course, was a merchant, as so many Jewish families have merchants in their family. And so this was, of course, always a big time of year for us. So it's just a wonderful time to come together. And I think Christmas has brought people of different faiths together more than probably any other holiday.
Oh, that's interesting. And congratulations,
Thank you, by the way.
Well, Kim, Christians from Orthodox traditions, as we just heard from Sumaya, celebrate Christmas Day on January 7th. The Coptic Christians do. So that simple question, when is Christmas, can show differences between the Christian denominations. Can you help illuminate for us the difference between a denomination and a religion?
Sure. So that's actually a more complicated question perhaps than you realize. But so there's a larger kind of Christian umbrella, which is people who are followers of Jesus. And then those kind of break down into three major parts. So you have Catholics, Roman Catholics, and they are our major presence in the world for sure. And then you have Coptic or Eastern Orthodox. You have kind of the Orthodox branch of Christianity, which do. They have a different calendar. They also have different festivals and ways of celebrating the major holidays. And then you have kind of the next barrel would be Protestants. And it's under Protestantism that you get the multiple denominations. So that's where you get Methodists and Presbyterians and Episcopalians and Baptists. That comes out of the Protestant branch.
Well, looking at Georgia's population, the Pew Research Center says about 79% of Georgians are Christians, commonly believe Jesus was God in human form, but don't always agree on much beyond that point. So if you drive down Peachtree Street in Atlanta, you know, you see rows of old churches from different denominations, and certainly in rural Georgia, old churches from lines of places that serve small sectors of towns with small populations. So help me understand why these differences seem to matter so much, that people choose to worship in separate churches representing separate denominations.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I will say, I think that in the future, we'll see less of that. In fact, that Christians will begin to come together under larger umbrellas of Christianity as our population of Christians continues to decline. I mean, there are already examples of that. If you have Presbyterian and Methodist churches that have combined, there are Episcopal churches and Lutheran churches that have combined to be one. But back to your question, there are some fundamental differences in theological beliefs about what it means to be a Christian that divides people. And so some people believe that you have to be baptized and you have to make that profession as an adult who has, you know, knowledge and reason and can make that decision, whereas others believe that you can be baptized as an infant and that is sufficient to save your soul. There's just a lot of kind of nuance in the same way that I think we go to the grocery store and there are 10 different types of peanut butter that we like to choose from. There are a lot of different types of Christianity that we choose from. And people hold to those differences with great value. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important to name that historically there are issues around race that have resulted in these divisions. So you have specifically African-American denominations, and that comes because white Christians did not allow black people to worship with them, right? Mm. So there are these long historic patterns also that have resulted in this type of division among Christians.
Right. So if you grew up in a Jiffy family rather than a Skippy family, there is this sort of idea of choosing. I mean, are we finding, you said something about, I thought that was really interesting, that you think that the divisions may disappear. So unlike much of our society, which is becoming more entrenched in quote unquote tribalism, you feel like there is more merging.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the larger tribe is the one of Christianity as opposed to these smaller denominations, and that's why there'll be this merging as we come together. And I think also you'll see people of faith in general coming together more. So these conversations that we're having about Jews and rabbis, Jewish rabbis and Christian pastors and Muslim imams getting together, it's because we are becoming a more minority population that just being a person of faith alone is something that will bring us together.
We're ringing in the new year with a roundtable of religious leaders and thinkers on today's On Second Thought. And our panelists are Kim Jackson, we just heard from her, Associate Rector of All Saints Episcopal Church, Sumaya Khalifa, she's Executive Director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau here in Atlanta, and Rabbi Robert Haas, he's for the Congregation Mikveh Israel in Savannah. I want to ask you about that, Sumaya, because most Americans probably don't know much about the denominations of Islam. And I do recall at the time of the Iraq War, wasn't there a majority of legislators who didn't know what was the difference between a Sunni and a Shia Muslim? How many subgroups does Islam have, and what are the big ones?
Okay. Well, in terms of world population, there's an estimate 1.9 billion Muslims around the world. And in the U.S., the estimate ranges from 3 to 10 million. A good number to go with is about 7 million. In Atlanta, is about 100,000. In Georgia, 125,000 Muslims. When we look at the Muslim community in the two big buckets, if you will, is Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims. And the difference between the two is that of a political difference. And that started after the death of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him. One group said the most competent leader becomes the leader for the Muslims. And another group said, no, it has to be somebody from the bloodline of Prophet Muhammad. Those who said the bloodline of Prophet Muhammad are now called the Shias, and the Sunnis are the ones who went with the most competent person at the time.
So despite these divisions, what's the uniting principle, if you will, of that Muslims share?
There are many. When you bring in a Sunni and a Shia, it's very hard to tell them apart because they believe in the same things. They believe in the oneness of God. They believe in the Prophet Muhammad. They do the prayers, do their fasting, everything. The differences would be how do they hold their hands when they're praying? Do they hold it like this, right in front of them?
You're putting your hands right, crossing in front of your chest.
Or having them next to them just, you know, straight. Mm-hmm. It just really, really minor differences. So I would say about 95% of their practices and beliefs are the same and about 5% that are different.
How about for you, Rabbi? What is the uniting principle of Judaism and the various branches of the religion?
Well, it's quite interesting because in Judaism, although they're different branches, we all get along all the time and never have issues with each other.
I've heard
which,
that.
Yeah, it's really quite amazing. But seriously speaking, there are differences. There's what you would call the more traditional, which are the Orthodox, the more liberal, and this is religiously, not politically, the more liberal would be the Reform movement, and then the middle would be what we call the conservative, and they differ on how they view what we call the halakha, the law of Judaism, based upon the Bible, but going into what we call the Talmud. So if you believe that we have to follow all these rules very strictly, you would be Orthodox. If you believe you're supposed to follow the ethical code strictly, but some of the religious rites not so much, then you'd be in the Reform. And in the conservative movement, it's about following the laws, but you are able to make some alterations here and there. I think all of us, though, believe that ethics are the center of our religion, certainly a belief in God, but you believe in God by the way you act. And when you act as a good human being, treating others as they should be spoken to, as they should be treated, which all three of these major religions believe in, then I think you're following what God wants you to do. And as a very small religion, it's very interesting for us to live in a free country because, you know, there's only maybe 13 million to 14 million Jews in the world, and almost all of them live in Israel or America. So I know my ancestors, the idea that they could live in a country like America where you could choose your own religion, which denomination, and have no worries that you're going to be persecuted, God willing, then that would have been the most incredible thing they could imagine. So I think A lot of times we are coming together as human beings, but I think we should revel in the fact that we have so many options, and there are very few countries in the world, even today, that give you so many options to find your place in religion and really seek it out, but also find no ramifications. And that's what America's gift is to the world, is these options. Let's enjoy them. Let's enjoy the differences. Hmm. And by the way, also, I'm more of a Peter Pan crunchy peanut butter person, just putting it out there.
Yeah. You had to make a distinction yes. here. Well, you all practice monotheistic faiths that share quite a bit of scripture. Christians read the Hebrew Bible as the Old Testament. Muslims call Jesus a great prophet. And people in many of the stories that show up in Christian and Jewish teachings also show up in other faiths. Okay, I'm asking you this with like 2 minutes until the break. Do you all worship the same God? Go.
Yes.
Yes.
Amen.
Yes.
Wow. That's a really, Absolutely. That's an interesting thing. So then how do you talk to the people inside of your faith about bridging that divide? Like, my belief in God is right? Or how do you even instruct on that?
If one is involved in interfaith conversations and they go in with my God is the right God or my religion is the right religion and yours is not, then it's not being on equal footage. To go into an interfaith conversation, we need to respect each other, as the rabbi said, and respect that we're coming at it from different ways and have conversation based on respect, understanding, and the will to hear, listen, and form friendships.
Okay, you're saying that as leaders, but living it is a different thing. And as we know, on the ground, it doesn't work quite like that. I want to pick this question up after the break, but Kim, if you got anything as we part, just to add to that.
So I will name that I'm married to a Muslim, and so I get to have these conversations
Whoa.
A lot. And
so this is just like dinner time for
this
you.
This is dinner time conversation for sure, but dinner time conversation that's lasted for 10 years as we've thought about what it means for me to be a Christian and for her to be a Muslim and those differences. So it's a broader question, but absolutely, we do serve and worship the same God.
All right, I want to pick that up. That's Kim Jackson from All Saints Episcopal Church in Atlanta. Also with us, Rabbi Robert Haas. He's from Congregation Mikvah Israel in Savannah. And Sumaya Khalifa. She is from the Islamic Speakers Bureau in Atlanta. And we're hearing music from religious New Year celebrations. This, we're representing here. This is the Mormon Tabernacle Choir singing a famous Advent carol. It's called Lo, How a Rose Ere Blooming. And we're going to continue our conversation after the break. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The vast majority of Georgians identify themselves as religious, and the majority of them as some form of Southern Baptist. Well, it is a population that has a lot of influence in the culture and politics of this state. At the dawn of the new year, we are talking with leaders and thinkers from faiths that are less represented. Sumaya Khalifa from the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta is with us, Kim Jackson from All Saints Episcopal Church in Atlanta, and Rabbi Robert Haas from Congregation Mikvah Israel in Savannah is also with us. So let's get into that. Let's get into politics and religion a little bit, because, you know, it's Thursday morning. So you're talking about people, obviously— you worship the same God, but people have different interpretations of that. And you have brought us many messages of responsibility and finding hope and representation. But on the ground, things are difficult. You know, it's difficult to walk away from your congregation or service and act with those kind of principles in mind all the time. So let's talk about, you know, do you think people who practice your faith are shaping politics as elected officials and voters acting upon their beliefs? Or do you think it's starting to go the other way, with politics influencing religious views and practices? Anyone want to pick that up?
Well, I think we have to understand we've never lived in a vacuum. Whether it comes to religion or politics, religions copy each other, take from each other. Same thing with politics. One side takes from the other, and it's the same thing with religion and politics. I mean, we live in this country in which legally they're not mixed, but we understand we're all people, so they are mixed in the way we view the world. And so our responsibility as leaders is to help ensure that religion does affect politics in a positive way. And it's a struggle always. I don't know if this year was worse than other years. You know, it certainly seems like it to many people. I think when we're watching the media all day and seeing what's going on, but I'm not sure. It's hard to know if it's worse than 30 years ago before we had so much media. But I do know that, you know, if we can find a way for us to help others understand that the person on the other side of the table simply has a different point of view, is not evil, or the person on the table on the other side of the table has a different point of view on this subject only, but on 67 other things they agree with you. But just because they have a different opinion on one thing doesn't make them the enemy. And I think that's the way religion can help influence politics, not to say, hey, you need to change your opinion, but hey, I appreciate your opinion and also understand that I agree with you on a lot of other different things.
Well, okay, so when do you take a stand, I guess, is a question. I remember reading the IFC, the Interfaith Council of Churches, listed a number of faith communities from evangelical leader Franklin Graham to the Hindu American Foundation opposed to separating families on the border, U.S. border. So when, where do you feel like you take a position?
Yeah, I think that that is a really difficult discernment that has to take place. But fundamentally, for me, my decisions about when to enter into the political arena and to express opinions have to be rooted in prayer and in conversation with other Christian leaders. I try not to ever go out there alone. Mm-hmm. That's not a good idea. But always, you know, with every issue, for example, I have a very strong stance against the death penalty and have made that a part of my life in ministry to fight against the death penalty. And that is completely and fully rooted in deep prayer and scripture and being really clear about where I am theologically as a Christian and why I have that stance. And so for me, any issue that comes forward, if prayer is not a central part of my discernment process as to whether or not I speak about it or preach about it, then I'm going to fall short. So I try to make sure that I'm intentional about praying and reading scriptures and having really good theological and ethical underpinning for why I'm entering into that conversation.
So you're entering it from drawing from the self and drawing from your practice of prayer and reflection. But what about when news events, you know, in early February 2018, the deadliest school shooting in U.S. history happened at a high school in Parkland, Florida. Students all over the country engaged in marches against gun violence. So what were the conversations then, you know, when something, a mitigating event like this, flares up and people are impassioned about it? How does your congregation message that to you and what they need and what they want?
Right. So, you know, we are in a really diverse congregation, and I want to be really clear that there are members of my congregation who feel like politics in the pulpit have no place.
Right.
They feel very clear about that. And so I don't want to misrepresent my congregation in any way. And at the same time, each of us preached about the Parkland shooting and made it really clear that the killing of children or the killing of people is wrong. And that is a clear ethical stance that we can name. And therefore, we want to create a world where violence is no longer. And that we borrow that from the Hebrew scriptures, right, where we talk about the lions laying down with the lambs. And we make really clear statements about shunning violence and evil. Now, how that gets played out, whether that's by going down to the Capitol for a rally or marching with the children, that's kind of up to the individual congregation. Certainly, we did have a number of members from our congregation. I was among them who went to the March for Our Lives with our children. But we did that recognizing that there are members of our congregation for whom that would not be the way that they would want to address the issue.
Well, Rabbi Robert, I'm going to pick up on this with you because we spoke with you on the show after the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh in October. Deadliest attack on Jewish people in the U.S. ever. Now, you were holding your yearly food festival at the time, that same weekend that news broke. But how about this? When something lands in your lap, now, this, of course, a shooting, but it was let's say, seized upon by a number of different people because of the political nature of it. The shooter was found to be somebody very active on social media who decried the Jewish faith for taking in refugees, helping refugees. So aligned himself on an immigration issue or an anti-immigration front. And many people thought that he was given permission, or that kind of hate speech has been given permission by the modeling after the speech of the president himself. So it became a political issue. How do you navigate that as a church leader?
Well, I think when you're a leader of a church or a synagogue or a mosque, it's a very, you know, tight rope sometimes. And I think the first thing you have to understand is you can't go into a congregation and preach all of these things before you first spend a few years getting to know your congregation. I think it's incumbent upon leaders first. Make friends, get to know people, let them know where you come from, find ways to show that you respect and honor them, even if you have a different opinion. So I think that is essential. Too many of us go in with fire and brimstone before we've gotten down on our knees and planted trees with our neighbors. So after that, I think as a religious leader, you have to pick which types of situations you really want to intervene. Where do you want to preach? Because you can't preach against everything because there's so many things happening all the time. For that particular case, gun violence, you know, it specifically hit our congregation very strongly because it was a brother congregation. But for us also, we had already been preaching against gun violence beforehand when it happened in Charleston to an African-American church, when it happened to schools. So it's something we were already doing. I think one of the things that we have to remember is that we're in this together. And so when something happens to another church or a mosque, that's when it's most important for my congregation to speak up. When it happens to a synagogue, it's almost understood that we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. But when it happens to somebody else, when, you know, somebody wrote terrible graffiti on one of the mosques in town on their fence, that's when we went with other churches and said, hey, we're here for you. When it happened to an AME church in Charleston, that's when we got together other churches and went to the AME church here for services and said, we're with you. And I think that's the most important thing for us to understand. We're all in it together. But I also think, and I'll hearken back to this respect thing, which is like the basis of my entire life, I think, it's we're all going to have different opinions, and that is okay. That's what we want. We want to have a system of government where we have different branches. We want to have a system of government with different parties. We want to have religions where there's different options. As long as people understand that the differences are okay and that we should revel and understand that that's the best way. Because if we have a country with one political party and with one religion, which everyone has to look at the world from the same perspective, we know where that gets you in the end.
Well, yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sumaya.
Oh, I just wanted to make a couple of points real quick. There's an organization in town called Outcry, and it is an interfaith organization working for solutions to make communities safe from gun violence.
Mm-hmm. This is in Atlanta.
And this is in Atlanta, yes. And they work through prayers, education, and advocating for of safety around guns. And when the Pittsburgh shooting happened, we partnered with the temple and we had a beautiful service with Rabbi Peter Berg about the shooting and how we all need to move into action in terms of gun violence. So this is something that is ongoing. Mm-hmm. The other thing I want to mention in terms of politics, there's also a silver lining in terms of the polarization that we have in our country right now. And that is women and minorities were excited to run for office, and they ran for office. And today we're marking history as two American Muslim women are being sworn in the U.S. Congress, which has not happened before. And one of them does cover her hair, and they had to change the rules of the Congress to allow for that. So we are making progress. It's slowly and surely. And I really appreciate what the rabbi has said in terms of respect and working together, and what also Kim has said about working together across differences, both within the religion and outside the religion as well.
Well, so this is getting to, we have a prevailing idea that we used to live, or America used to be, a unified, civically engaged country based on the dominant population. And it was largely governed by white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant men. Now the country is well on its way to being a majority-minority country. So in a way, we have to make room for, or the onus is upon us, I think, as a culture to make room for presenting different populations and interests. But there's a kind of way that religion is, you're talking about religions coming together or faiths coming together, but there is, I think, a dominant idea that people kind of get more entrenched inside of their tribe. So you're talking to your congregations, you're talking to, you know, the rabbi in town or the imam in town, Kim. But those divisions are deep and in a way haven't been as present in our cultures before. How does an old religion adapt to that?
Yeah, so I want to make some distinctions here. Mm-hmm. I do speak as an African American, right. And as an African American, I don't think that we have been able to have these like enclaves where it was just Black Protestant Christians together. Mm-hmm. We've been in relationship across religion because they're members of our families who are Muslim and Black Muslims, right? And so I think it's just really important to name that there is this distinction for minority populations where we actually don't get to just be by ourselves. We've learned to be in relationship with the Jewish people because our struggles were similar as African Americans in this country, right? But I think to your broader question around Christianity adapting, some of that means Christians acknowledging and being humble about the ways in which we've caused harm in this country, the ways in which our theologies, particularly historically around issues like slavery, were used to enslave a group of people and repenting. Like this is the work of the church, I think, of today is to repent about our sinfulness and our complicity in creating a culture in which certain people were in and others were out, in which certain people were good and others were bad. Certainly, I see that as a part of my job as a Christian minister is to name my religions, my faith's complicity in creating these unsafe cultures and environments. So I think that's the first step as we begin to tear down these walls and to open up our nation to a way of leading and being led by people of a variety of faiths.
Well, I know that one of the conversations that you're thinking about for your congregation in 2019 is marking the 400-year anniversary of enslaved people coming to the United States. So You are also bringing them to the Lynching Memorial and a group which was unveiled in 2018. I actually just saw it a couple weeks ago on my holiday break. It was enormously, this is in Montgomery, Alabama, enormously powerful. But in even saying that, we are going to acknowledge this. We are going to go back and revisit that and look at our complicity. That becomes a divider issue in many ways. You know, I was reading about the response to this lynching memorial. There were people who in the state legislature who refused to come to the opening. They feel like we don't need to go over this again. You know, leave it in the past. It's too painful. These memories are too much. And Sumaya mentioned, you know, organizing around safety and guns. That too, people reads, you know, gun control. So you are entering into these political quagmires in a way. What is the moral? What is the religious? What is your calculation on how to address those?
Yeah, I think that when it comes to repenting, that is a fundamentally Christian principle that we are called to. And so that's my drive towards us both reviewing the history of Christianity in this country and then in turn repenting. And there also is something that we borrow from our Jewish brothers and sisters, our Jewish siblings, around remembering the past, the importance of marking the journey and the path. So for Jewish people, and Rabbi, you can speak to this better than I can, but there is this marking of the passage from Egypt and crossing over the Red Sea. And they remember that as a way of grounding themselves and then also moving forward. And so I think as Christians, we borrow from that tradition and we remember also our past and the ways that we have both marred the path and the ways that we have also forayed new paths that have been beautiful and holy. And so that's rooted and grounded in our scriptural traditions that we walk this road. And the rabbi said earlier, it is a tightrope. Mm. It is definitely a tightrope when we begin to enter into these political conversations, but it is so crucial to being, I think, true, faithful Christians in this world is for us to walk that road and to mark the past.
Well, I'm just going to pivot here, I'm afraid, because we want to draw to a close, or we have to. I actually don't want to. But, you know, all people, faith is about being tested. You know, it's about coming back to faith. And I'm wondering about, for you personally, you obviously, I'm sure, have conversations with people in your communities about doubt or not having faith. Is there a way that you in particular wrestle with or practice living with doubt?
Well, I think doubt is a part of the way we live. But before that, I want to say, first of all, the three of you would make better rabbis than I am. So if you ever think about going that place, just, you guys are really amazing. You know, some people live their life without doubt. They're so sure of themselves that they can't even imagine it. And that, I think, is one of the issues. Doubt is a part of our very fabric of being, and it keeps us honest. And some people worry about it and think we shouldn't have too much of it, but doubt really allows us to even look more into ourselves and try and find what we really believe. And as we evolve as human beings and as a country, we have to understand that this is all part of the process. We are getting better as we go along, but it's not a straight line going up. It kind of dips and goes up. And, you know, it's kind of like the economy. We hope at the end it's gone up a lot, but there's going to be dips all over. At least I do now that I have a kid from my retirement. But it's important for us to, as we heard earlier, to remember the past so that we're not doomed to repeat it. But it's also for us to remember the past so that we will repeat our successes. And I think sometimes we do look at our world in such a negative way, and we look at the past and say it was so amazing, and we forget how amazing our world is today. Right. I read all of the biographies for a while on our founding fathers, you know, and these were amazing men, Franklin and Jefferson and Washington, and they all really hated each other, but yet they worked together. It was quite amazing.
Robert Haas, Kim Jackson, Sumaya Khalifa, I'm going to have to leave you all to simmer on this question of doubt in this 2019, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.